supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The way we organize our homes and our workspaces seems to say a lot about our personalities. When we see a pristine space where everything is in place, nothing is out of order, we think anal. Clutter everywhere suggests chaos. There's something wrong with that person. But what does the way we organize really say about us, and how does it affect our lives and those around us? That's what we're looking at today during the first part of our show. Later on, we'll discuss hoarding. Joining me now are Rachel Teacher. She is a therapist specializing in organizing adults with ADD. She's been in private practice in the Philadelphia area for 8 years. Rachel, welcome
to
the show. I'm also joined by Dr. Martin Marty Franklin. He's an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, specializing in anxiety disorders. Marty, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Marty, let's start with you. Everybody, it seems, has a different threshold for what it means to be organized. I can go into one house that looks chaotic and I'm not happy, but everybody there looks pretty comfortable. And another, you go into a house and it looks like an operating room, and somebody can be terribly stressed if one thing is out of place. So what does it really mean, this need for organization?
Well, I think that we all have needs to handle the incoming information and the incoming clutter, if you will, that comes into our lives every day. And some people are just simply more comfortable sort of tolerating it in their presence, and other people have more difficulty with that. And it, you know, may well map onto some more clinically oriented themes that come up and will come up later in the show, I'm sure. I think the hard part is when you have a house that has a split, the house divided, so you've got people who, one person loves the sort of the chaos and other people have a hard time tolerating that. Leads to interpersonal stress.
Yeah, I don't want to get into any sexist difficulties here, but an awful lot of the couples I treat, she wants more organization and he just doesn't care. So she becomes the nag, and he becomes passive resistant or passive aggressive or whatever you want to call him. How does one navigate those waters?
I think what you're going to have to do there is you're going to have to deal with the fact that your chosen way of being is affecting my way of being, and we have to find some compromise in those common spaces. And maybe you've got a place where an area of the house or a particular room that you can leave your way, but we have an agreement about common space and how we're going to handle that, and that can reduce that kind of stress.
Rachel, it seems when we talk about these conflicts that the people who want it more organized, whether they win or not, we lean towards them as being more right. Is that also the case with workspace, too?
Absolutely. There is a tendency to make the people who are more organized seem sort of morally right, in the right
morally,
position.
Yeah, morally, that's the
there's
word.
There's a judgment absolutely there. I think what that overlooks is that although someone else's, whether it be in the home or in the office, although their space may look chaotic and be really distressful, it makes a lot of sense to them, perhaps. So I think it's important to keep as much judgment out of anyone's organizing style as is possible.
Oh, yeah. So hard to do. I've got a very dear friend of mine who's in the clergy, and that means he works at least 60 hours a week. But within those 60 hours, he's incredibly organized. Mm-hmm. His sermons are prepared. People get supervised. The building gets managed. And that's not all. I mean, he's up to date on politics, the arts, literature. He's up to date on his tropical fish tank.
Right.
I mean, he's got everything in place. I hate this guy. I mean, I just hate him because he's all the things I wish I could be
right.
in another life.
Right.
So how can you not be judgmental?
I think that it's very important to understand that organizing, and whether you're disorganized, if you've got clutter, or if you're very organized, it's all very personal. Everyone's got a different set of traits and history that they're bringing to every present condition. So he may have always been that way, you know, or he may be someone who, or like myself, just wasn't organized sort of to begin with and had to learn how to do that in order to make his life function at the greatest capacity.
But there is a value, and I should just say, Barry, I really don't hate you, but I really do, because there's a part of me that wants to be like him. I tell myself I'd be more comfortable, more knowledgeable, less stressed if I was like him. Am I right, Marty?
You may and you may not be. I mean, it cuts both ways, and I think that to me it comes down to what's most efficient for you. So it could well be that I look at the other side of that. I look at the person you described before, who's got an operating room for a living room, and I wonder how much effort, cost, time, and focus on that at the exclusion of doing other things went into making it to look that way. At least that's what I tell myself when I go to my neighbor's house and it looks much better than ours. That they must be costing
themselves. Efforts to maintain that could be just as stressful.
Exactly.
As the person who is disorganized and can't find their keys and can't get out of the house for 20 minutes.
So the underpinnings of what we're talking about here is stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I notice, you know, the underpinnings of my thinking about organizing myself is every day I see little bits of chaos in my life and I say, well, I've got work to do, so I'll get to that when the work is done. And these days, the work's never done. I don't know if it ever was done, but it seems worse now. The work is just never done, so you never get to it. So where do you decide? How do you decide?
I think many people come to what may be thought of as a breaking point, but I think it's also really a starting point. If you've really hit that wall and it's just too stressful to look around and see what's happening, then the motivation really sort of clicks in. And I don't think that any real change is going to happen until you've hit that starting point. And then it's a matter of figuring out, how is it that this has gotten to this place for me? What are my styles? What can I do to work best with my own organizational approach to enhance that quality of my life?
Now, I know you work with ADD. Marty, I want to turn to you. At some level, the underpinnings of this is an anxiety disorder, or at the very least, anxiety management.
Yeah, certainly can be.
So when you've got more than your fair share of anxiety, and because of that, you're not able to get organized, or because of that, you hold on to things you shouldn't hold on to, you've got to do more than make a decision, or do you? Or is that where it starts?
I think it's a continuum. And so I think that there are, one of the fundamental motivations that comes from being anxious is avoidance. So you walk into the room, it's too much to bear, and rather than take that first step, you take a step backwards and out of the room. I just can't deal with this now. I'll just leave it like it is. And I think that's part of where we're helping somebody tolerate that anxiety and break this thing down into doable steps is going to be helpful in sort of getting past looking at it as an entire project, but these are the 18 pieces of this project and they're manageable. The other side of it, where anxiety rears its ugly head, is in terms of what we decide to keep. And when you have that logic of, I might need this someday, or somewhere down the line, someone's going to ask me a question about this, and I have to have the information, and if that feeling makes you anxious to be caught off guard, to not have what you need, It may lead you to make decisions about keeping things that don't need to be kept.
Well, there's another issue now that complicates it even more, and I'll talk about my life. That's cyber clutter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my office can look pretty neat, but there is just so much crap going on inside of my computer. I mean, I've got 3 or 4 lectures that are one-third written. I've got about 14 column ideas that mm-hmm. are, you know, have... And they're not organized, they're not, you know?
Yeah.
Is that qualitatively different than clutter you see in the workplace, Rachel?
I think that can have absolutely the same impact, the same stressful impact, knowing that it's there. It's something that overwhelms you. Just because you're not visually seeing it doesn't mean it's not having that energetic drain and that taking that toll on your life and your productivity.
Let's go to the phones. We got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. By the way, we're talking about clutter and organizations, how they fit with our personality and how we use them often to manage anxiety. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let's talk with Lori. Lori, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I think, Dr. Dan, I think you may need to drop some things from your life in order to get a little more organized. You've got a lot going on.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Anyway,
yes, Mom.
I was going to say that, personally, I think that it has everything to do with priorities. I personally am, you know, I am as organized as I want to be. And it's funny, I mean, my sister-in-law is like the operating room kitchen, and I will never be that because it's not a priority. I get to the point where I organize as much as I want, and, you know, I will literally put a load of wash in and not do the second one because it's just, I would rather spend that time, you know, listening to NPR or whatever. I mean, just, it's just for me very much a very... But I'm organizing as much as I want, and it's a priority up to that point.
I love Lori.
I think that's a great point.
I love Lori.
The good enough organizing.
And,
works
and the,
for you.
And the NPR good enough organizing person.
That's a good priority.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. There's one thing Lori brings out, though. She makes a conscious decision about what's important, and I wonder about the majority of people who don't make a conscious decision so that they won't do the second load of laundry. They might listen to the radio instead, but it's not a conscious decision, so they beat themselves up for not doing the second load of laundry and feel anxious and guilty.
Yes, I agree. I think that's getting back to earlier, taking the shame out of how organized you are or may not be. And if you... go ahead and do make the decision. I'd like to get these things under control and have my life feel comfortable for me at a level where if I don't get to the second load, I'm okay with that. But there is a lot for people that it doesn't come naturally. There's a certain amount of retraining. There are things you need to learn, new skills you have to implement that are not going to come naturally. And hopefully you can ride the motivation of the decision to make it a habit.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking about the underpinnings of this being anxiety, and of course, Marty, you specialize in anxiety. But I know so many people, we all do, who, when they've hit the ultimate anxiety, life or death, losing a loved one, facing death on their own, all of a sudden, priorities are clear, and all of this shame about organization goes away. And I wonder, what's that connection? What is it about facing the big anxiety that all of a sudden makes all of this stuff less stressful? Marty, any thoughts?
I mean, I think it forces you to put things in order, if you will, pardon the pun. I think it allows you an opportunity to say, okay, if you're facing something like life and death, you have to make decisions at that point as to where do I want to spend my time. Do I want to spend my time having a perfectly clean kitchen, or do I want to spend my time, you know, doing productive things and being with the people I want to be with? So I think sometimes for people that can sort of jolt them into shifting those priorities. But I also wonder if people who are anxious already, that something like that, something life and death, something big and serious like that, could actually exacerbate them and make them kind of even more anxious about those sorts of things as well. Because I think it kind of depends on where you were when you started, when you had that crisis. So we certainly see that a fair amount, that when you have people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, for instance, and they go through a life crisis, typically they don't get better. Their symptoms get worse over time.
That makes sense. Well, as a generic psychotherapist, I always find that it's helpful to ask the big questions and to have all of us ask the big questions. What is your life about?
Yep.
What do you want it to be about? What do you want to look back on when you don't have this life anymore? And begin with the big questions and then work your way down to the crap on the kitchen table and what you want to do and when you want to do that.
Right. And then it cuts the other way too, which is if you want your life to be about the big things and putting your time where it should be, you also don't want to spend a lot of that time looking for your bills. And so that's where the organizational piece can actually be helpful
great.
In moving you more towards where you want to be and what you want to be doing and who you want to be with.
Interesting perspective. But we've got to take a short break. We'll be back. One of the things we're going to come back with is Mike and Scott invited Rachel Teacher to come into her workplace, which I think was a pretty courageous act for both of you. Rachel put on her contamination suit and she wandered in there, and she seems like she did okay. We're gonna hear how that went. We're talking about clutter and disorganization, and soon we'll be talking about Mike and Scott in some more detail. My guests are Rachel Teacher. She's a therapist specializing in organizing adults with ADD. She's here in private practice in Philadelphia. Dr. Marty Franklin's an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and he specializes in anxiety disorders. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY, USP's undergraduate biology program, educating students in all aspects of living organisms, from their molecular structure to the ecosystems in which they live. USP's location in Philadelphia promotes opportunities for internships and collaboration with universities and professionals from life science, biotechnology, and pharmaceutical corporations. Further details at www.usp.edu/biology.
As the Philadelphia City Council talks about how to spend the $4 billion in taxes paid by everyone who lives, works, or plays in the city, we want you to have your say. WHYY, in partnership with the Daily News, presents It's Our Money, reports on the city budget not only in a way that you can understand, but also in a way in which you can participate. To give your testimony about the city's priorities for the coming year, visit our website at whyy.org and click on It's Our Money.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Clutter, disorganization, and anxiety. And that's what we're talking about today with Dr. Marty Franklin. He's an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at Penn School of Medicine. Rachel Teacher is also with me. She's a therapist specializing in organizing adults with ADD. I wanted, and when we, in our latter half of our show, we're going to talk about what happens at its extremes. We're going to be talking about hoarding. Marty, I want to talk about mood states and clutter. We've touched on anxiety a few times, but clearly when one is depressed or despondent, things will tend to get disorganized, but that also happens with stress. People get disorganized. So what is it about our brains where big emotions happen, organization's the first thing to go?
I my sense of it is there's only so much that one brain or one person can manage at a time. And when you push into, I mean, especially when you're talking about, I think depression's maybe the most clear example. where you've got the negative effects, you've got these horrible thoughts and bad feelings about the world and yourself, but you've also got this low energy. And when low energy is present, it's just you look at a task like cleaning your kitchen or cleaning the garage, and it just seems something that might take you an hour feels just impossible.
And that happens even with sadness, too.
Yeah, oh yeah. But for some people, those are more temporary things. So I've decided I'm going to give myself a break today. I'm not going to do my usual organizing. I'm going to let it go. But when it persists, when the sadness persists, when the sadness is so big that it starts to overwhelm you and get to the point where that becomes the norm, where just not functioning becomes the norm, is where you start to see organizational systems, especially if they're not well set up to begin with, they break down pretty quickly.
Rachel, I'm sure you see the connection between clutter and emotion in the workplace. How so?
There's a tremendous tendency to become very overwhelmed very quickly. If you visually are overwhelmed, you're not going to be able to sort of think things through, use the sort of step-by-step approach that might normally make sense to you. And I think what happens also in offices in particular a lot is that they're organized a lot around sort of very traditional, conventional learning styles and organizing systems such as the file folders. You know, people are really trained to put things away in that manner. And for many people who have a different processing style, once you get something in that file folder, it's gone. It may as well be, you know, in the basement. So a lot of people, I think, can sort of get tripped up trying to keep up with an organizational system that doesn't make sense to them, and especially in the workplace where it may not be as sort of friendly a place to make changes.
Well, let's now see what happened when Mike and Scott gave you a call and asked for help organizing her desk area.
Now, you've come here today to take a look at my workspace, and I'm surprised you didn't faint when you got here.
Not as bad as you think, I will say. And we've looked around a little bit, and the good news is, which is what I find a lot, once there's sort of an initial purge done, there is going to be so much room, so much space to actually use that's sort of not being utilized efficiently so far.
Now, when you walk through a typical work building, you'll see desks that are really neat, really organized, and then you'll see desks that are more like this one, where there's stuff everywhere, there's books, there's pens, it looks like chaos. Is that indicative of a person's style, of their personality?
There can be all sorts of things that contribute to someone's organizing style, or sometimes lack thereof. It may be that you just never sort of learned this sort of principles and the system that would make sense to you and be easy to maintain. Or there could be issues at work like ADD, things that might interfere with your sort of actual ability to find those systems. Also, some people just as thinkers like to see everything. It makes more sense to them when they can actually see everything, and it may look a mess to some people, but they know exactly where something is. They will find it. They are visual thinkers, and it makes sense to them even though it looks chaotic to other people.
So if lack of organization doesn't cause a problem for a person, is it a problem? If they like to see everything, have everything out on their desk, it might look terrible to other people, but if it doesn't cause a problem for them, should they even worry about it?
I would say no. I would say if you can find what you need, if you feel you're operating at an efficient level, it's not bothering you, then I think you're okay. It's mostly about, you know, what feels good for you, not just being sort of efficient, but how does it feel? And if it's coming naturally, then that's what's going to work the best.
Now, let's take a look at my work area here. I feel like I just have way too many things. I have too many books, too many CDs. Now, they all relate to what I do at work, but I just can't keep track of it all.
Right. And one of the things that I see happening in this area and the shared space as well, first of all, as we discussed, there's going to be lots of room once we sort of go through and get rid of things that are just sort of no longer necessary or relevant. But there doesn't appear to be a whole lot of actual zoning taking place. So what you could do is get a lot more of all of the like items together and really give them an assigned place.
So once I've purged, then I should start thinking in zones, like organizing my belongings.
Yes.
How does that work?
That works. Like is going to go with like. So just looking at the office, there are lots of CDs around, there are tapes around, there's books, there's some sort of, you know, kitchen items. And once your drawers and shelves are clear, you will be able to have all of those things together rather than some things here, some things over there, which just sort of, you know, adds to this kind of mishmash feeling.
Now, is my work done once I've created the zones and everything is in place?
Maintenance is the key often, and I think that that is a place where people get tripped up in organizing a lot. I think that people feel that it's sort of like a one-shot deal, and once they really get organized, then they're good to go. But it's a process, and you really need to figure out, again, what system is going to work best for you that you're going to be able to maintain in a way that's not going to drain you, but that's going to come naturally and make sense.
So how often should I think about that? If something new comes in, do I have to immediately think, okay, today I got a new book, where is this book going to go? And, you know, how do I kind of keep up with it? Do I have to purge every month? What's the system here?
I think in a situation like this, I would, certainly the paper as much as you can, I would hit on a daily basis, get rid of things you don't need right away, because paper piles up so quickly. The books could be once a week or so, and definitely once a month, just the overall sweep.
Okay, I'll get started on this, and then we'll see how it works out. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. Good luck.
Well, that was Rachel Teacher, who joins me here in the studio, wading through Mike and Scott's workplace. I have to tell you, I came into the workspace today for the first time since you've come, and my first reaction is, oh my God, did somebody die? Now, we're not going to analyze that,
right.
Okay? We're just going to leave that where it is. But that's the way it looked like there was a whole human here missing.
We were really able to do a very thorough job there, and this was sort of almost a unique situation working in the studio here. There were three of us working for about a two-hour period of time, and Mikan was actually a very organized person. There were systems in place. What was happening was more of a space issue. There hadn't been a real purge for a while, so once we sort of went through and saw what she could either archive or move someone else or delegate or give to another person, so much space opened up, and the work really was pretty smooth.
So one question I had was, when she said it was chaos and you said it wasn't so bad, I mean, the question in my mind, I'll turn to you, Marty, are we talking about somebody who's tends to be more compulsive and anal, whose work life isn't meeting their expectations, might be unreasonable expectations?
Certainly is possible. I think the one thing I would say that came across in the work that you did, and I think it's extremely relevant for what you do, and it's also relevant for the people who are at the more extreme.
Let me interrupt you there. Mm-hmm. Our listeners can see the work that Rachel did on our webpage. We've got before and after pictures there.
Yeah.
Of it's whyy.org/voices, and you can actually see the workspace and Mikan being held down as she's trying to hold on to some.
And it didn't take that long. But the thing that really was evident was the lack of judgment you mentioned earlier. You came to it, and she was already cringing as far as, oh, you're not going to like this, and you just sort of smoothed that over. Because I think that people who allow it to kind of get beyond where they're comfortable, because clearly she's not comfortable with the workspace, as it turned out, and was maybe uncomfortable sharing that. You got rid of that right away. And once you did that, then you were able to break it down into smaller steps and do all the things you were saying before. But that first piece of not judging the space and saying, oh, I can't believe it, this is hideous,
right,
none of that was there. And it made the work easier.
I want to come to some language here that really strikes me, some language specifically that you used, Rachel. And the language of purge and maintenance, and we're going to touch on it when we talk about hoarding, kind of holding on to. This is, we're talking about an eating disorder here, and, you know, purging, and the issue with the reason diets don't work is because the changes don't get maintained. Do you see parallels, Marty?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why we would strongly recommend that people who are going to go and get treatment for hoarding, that they go into a maintenance phase for treatment, that we don't think the intensive model of working at this for a month or so and then stopping is going to help these people in the long run.
Well, what about any treatment for an anxiety disorder or OCD or Rachel, your treatment? I mean, do we need a maintenance program? Is this a chronic issue, Marty?
Well, I think these are sometimes even formed in temperament very early on. And so I do think that if you have an anxiety disorder, acute treatment can be helpful. But you do need to pay attention to fading from acute treatment into a maintenance phase where the person takes more responsibility for being sort of responsible for putting the program in place and then fading over time. And there's plenty of studies saying that maintenance treatment can help you maintain your acute gains in the short run.
And maybe that's one of the reasons 12-step programs are so successful to the extent that we can measure is because the message is you're not going to get cured of this and walk away.
Absolutely.
You've got to keep an eye on it for the rest of your life. Do you feel that way about the people you work with?
I do very much. I think, as I said earlier or in the piece, I think that it's a mistake that people make often in thinking that getting organized is a sort of one-shot deal and they do it and they're done. Especially if you've never been organized and then it's so exciting to sort of arrive at that place that you've always envisioned. But in reality, it's a process. It's an ongoing, it's an evolution, and you're going to have to tweak your system sometimes. Different people may move in and out of your home. Something's always going to happen to change what you set up, and you have to be able to accommodate and realize that if you drop the ball, you're going to end up in the same situation.
My timing might be off here because it's potentially a big topic and we've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to talk about how you organize people with ADD, and is it different from organizing someone in the workplace or not?
It can be very different. ADD people have a great amount of intelligence and creativity and perseverance in many ways that I don't see all the time. And in working with someone like that, there's always a new approach sort of comes out of the situation. And for many ADDers, there's, you know, very specific techniques that help a lot more than they might with others. Again, getting away from the filing folders, anything that gets hidden is going to go away. So finding new ways to keep things out and about, but not necessarily in your way, something transparent folders. ADD people really respond well to color coding for their filing systems. There are also sort of the vertical ways to organize. Instead of having your horizontal cabinets hold everything and maybe mounting things up to keep them in view might work better.
Where does this knowledge base come from?
How do you mean? I'm sorry.
Give me a second. I'll find my thought
okay.
here. How do you know what you know about organizing people with ADD?
Oh, there's been a whole lot of experiences I've had leading up to that. There's friends and family members that have shown me so much about how to sort of approach different ways of trying to keep on top of things. And for myself, as I said earlier, I'm not a natural organizer. I had to do a bunch of learning myself to get to this place. And it really sort of, you know, got to a point in my life where it wasn't just I couldn't find the keys. I needed to get my bills out on time. So I needed to really start to understand what was going on, how was I thinking, what did I need to do to shore myself up to make my life not so stressful in those ways.
So it was necessity that
Absolutely.
Got you into this business, which is how I became a psychotherapist. I needed to be in therapy full time, so
right.
here I am.
There you go.
We have to take our break now. Rachel, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Rachel is an organizing expert, and you can find more information about her and her work online at www.hopeandspace.com. Coming up, we'll be talking about hoarding. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
St. Mary Medical Center is pleased to support WHYY. Every day, St. Mary Heart Specialists work to solve complex cases with new procedures. St. Mary Specialists help stop heart attacks and strokes with a patch the size of a coin, repair and replace faulty heart valves through a 2-inch incision, and correct irregular heartbeats with radio frequency energy. These procedures are being performed today at St. Mary Medical Center. St. Mary Medical Center. It's your health. Expect more.
Next time on Day to Day. Some Republicans in Texas are not happy.
They're disappointed with some of the aspects of Republican leadership here as well as nationally.
So how are they going to vote on Tuesday?
Jesus ain't on the ballot. You're not going to have a perfect candidate. So get the values you think are most important and go find and support those.
The future of the Texas GOP. Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Let's turn to another topic that's related to clutter and organization, and that's hoarding. Joining us now is Dr. David Tolan. He's co-author of the book Buried in Treasures, a self-help guide for compulsive hoarding, saving, and collecting. He's also the founder and director of the Anxiety Disorders Center at the Institute for Living in Connecticut. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And we still have Marty Franklin with us. He's an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania, and he also specializes in anxiety. David, let's start with you. Help us in understanding the hoarding phenomenon. I read where between 25 and 40% of people with OCD have hoarding symptoms. So is it part of OCD or is it a separate disorder?
Well, we're not entirely sure about the degree of overlap. The part of the problem is which group of people you choose to look at. When we go into OCD clinics, what we find, just as you've said, is that roughly a third of people have some degree of hoarding. But when we've done studies in which we recruited people specifically who had compulsive hoarding symptoms, what we find is that only a minority of them show any signs of OCD, which leads me to suspect that there are probably a couple of different kinds of people who hoard. There are some people who have features that are similar to OCD, but then there's this other group, and that hasn't been studied very, very thoroughly, that really doesn't seem to resemble OCD in any meaningful way.
Tell us what we're talking about when, give us a visual when
Sure.
you talk about hoarding.
Well, when we talk about compulsive hoarding, what we're talking about are people who have acquired and then subsequently failed to discard a large volume of objects that most people would consider to be of extremely limited value, if not outright worthless. So when we go into the homes of many people who hoard, what we tend to see are stacks and stacks of things that the average observer would probably call junk. Now, the person who owns them doesn't necessarily refer to them that way. Sometimes they see it as something very different. But we tend to see things like old newspapers, magazines, a lot of junk mail. A lot of the time we'll see used food containers, things that really don't have much practical value or much sentimental value, but it just gets stacked up, and often it gets to the point where the stack goes from floor all the way to ceiling, so that even to get through a room, you have to climb over piles of clutter or sometimes go through little paths that have sort of been carved through the mess.
So here I am talking to two OCD guys, and when you think OCD, you think avoidance of dirt and clutter and need to be organized. Marty, how does that work?
Well, I think there's a lot of different presentations that fall under the umbrella of OCD. And I would imagine that most people who have hoarding as their primary symptom probably wouldn't have the contamination element, although you do even see that overlap too, which makes this very complicated. So if you have somebody who's primarily hoarding because they feel like they might need something someday, that sort of quintessential anxious logic. If they then also have contamination fear, it's another reason, perhaps, that they wouldn't go ahead and discard.
Well, let's go to the phones. We've got Edie on the line. Edie,
yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I don't know if I'm a hoarder, but I know that the idea of purging is, at the very least, unpleasant. It makes my stomach kind of turn, and that every time I do anything to organize things, it just sort of comes back again. And sometimes I just end up kind of clearing the piles off into, like, bags. I mean, I have bags and bags from different parties that were happening. I clear everything off because we're going to have people over, and then it just kind of happens again. And, I mean, I've been dealing with this for years.
Before we turn to our experts, could I ask you to say a little bit more, describe a little bit more your phrase, makes your stomach turn? What really happens to you with the prospect of getting rid of stuff?
Well, I've sometimes wondered if it was that I didn't want to get rid of things because it's like the one thing I can keep track of, you know, is stuff. I can't keep track, make sure people stick around or whatever, or animals, but stuff I can keep.
So when you say your stomach turns, it's about loss. Yes, it's
fear. Yeah, I
fear,
think so.
Fear of loss. All right. Well, let's ask David.
Yeah.
Edie wants to know if she's a hoarder. Does this sound like hoarding?
Well, the way that we define hoarding, and certainly I can't tell you, Edie, whether you're a hoarder or not, but we would typically consider somebody to be showing compulsive hoarding behaviors when their behavior, that is, their saving and their acquiring and the clutter that results from it, has gotten severe enough that it causes functioning to break down. So, for example, I'm like some of the people that you heard about earlier in the show, where my office is a mess and my desk is a mess, and I've been to Marty's office and I know his is too. But the bottom line is that our desks still function as desks. I mean, even though there's stacks of stuff on it, you know, we're able to use our computer, we're able to use our telephone, we could sit down and write a letter at the desk. It still serves those functions. But when we talk to people who hoard, the clutter has built up to a point where the living space or the workspace has essentially become nothing but storage.
Edie?
Yes?
Does your clutter in your house, does that interfere with your function?
Definitely. Okay. But not. I mean, I've been to people's houses where you can barely walk through the house. It's not like that. But it seems like it gets harder and harder to change it and to get things better.
Well, let me turn back to you, David. Whether she has this label of hoarding, mm-hmm. or anxiety or whatever the label is.
Right.
One of the things she is teaching us is that she may have had a lot of loss in her life, mm-hmm. and she's scared of losing more stuff. So isn't that the issue here that needs care?
Yeah, I think that's probably a more important issue than, you know, whether we would apply a diagnostic label. What we do find is that different people hoard for very different reasons, and what Edie's talking about really rings true with a lot of the people that we have talked to, in which they hoard because of a sense of emotional attachment to objects. So we've had lots of people, for example, that have said things like, well, if I had to throw this away, it would be like throwing away an old friend, or it would be like throwing away a part of me. Now, all of us probably have some things like that. I mean, we might have a sweater that our grandma made for us, or, you know, a couple of things that have real sentimental value. But for people who hoard, at least some of them, what we find is that sense of sentimentality becomes overgeneralized, so that it instead of being toward a few sentimental items, it becomes toward the contents of a room.
Well, let's go back to the phones because I think our next caller might have some similar feelings. We've got Ancha on the line.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I was born in Germany, and I live in the United States. I'm 52 years old, and the complication for me is that I've been the recipient of items from generations and generations of my family. And my family in Germany were refugees, and babies died in both of the last wars, and I am the only child of my father's second marriage. So I was born when he was 62 or 3, and my mother was 41. And they are older siblings, but they are all 80 and above and are exhibiting more and more senility. So I am kind of both the recipient of stories as well of things. And I have now maybe 5 sets of dishes that were painted by great aunts. And
oh my God.
I have boxes and boxes of family things. And they were really cherished because people had lost their farms and people had lost everything in their lives. So
what? Yes. So what's the problem here?
What is the problem?
Yeah.
Yeah, the problem is that I don't have the energy to sort it all out. What am I going to do with it? And it feels like I'm killing off what's left of people who are already dead, or if I give something away to people who are not family members or who don't cherish it, they will not know where this came from or the stories associated with it. It's really, I feel, this incredible burden.
This is your life here, your history. Marty?
Yeah, that's a tremendous burden. And David Tolan, one of his therapists some years ago, was treating somebody with a very similar flavor who'd lost somebody very close. And when the therapist was working with this woman, she looked at him and she was holding a stack of printed material that was relevant to this person she lost. And she said to him, as they were thinking about discarding it, the woman said to him, but these are memories. And the therapist said something I thought was very wise. And he said, well, the memories are in you rather than in the things. And I think that was enabled her to make some decisions as to discarding some of the material while focusing on the memories and the family and the relevance of the material. I've even seen people do things like take pictures of cherished old dishes and the like and take pictures of them and save the pictures and get rid of the boxes. Because, again, back to Dave's point, which is you need to be able to function today in the context of your own home and life.
Well, and in a way, it is like a death.
Yeah.
Throwing these things away. It is like a death, and things die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has to be mourning in there. I can almost hear it in her voice, yeah. A quality mm-hmm. of mourning, and that's something we all go through with our stuff.
There's kind of this holding on aspect to it, but, you know, part of it is, you know, part of what I'm hearing is that you're hanging on to these things because it feels to you like that's a way of honoring the memories of your relatives. And the question that comes to my mind is if your relatives could come into your home and see what's going on, is that what they would want for you? Is that how they would want you to honor them?
And not just for her, but for subsequent generations.
Yeah.
I mean, if she feels this burden, even if she manages it for the rest of her life, she hands it down and the burden grows along with the history. So what does she want for her progeny?
Yeah.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult to voluntarily let things go that are that precious, which brings up the question, and again, I wish we had more time about treatment. How do we help someone like that? Anybody want to tackle that, David?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that this is a work in progress, and I'd like to say that we've come up with a wonderful, miraculous cure, and unfortunately, I'd be lying if I said that. I mean, there's a couple things that we know, which is that the standard treatments that are out there don't work very well. There isn't a medication that works very well for compulsive hoarding.
Most traditional forms of talking therapy don't seem to do much. There is some promise in a treatment that's called cognitive behavior therapy, the very specific kind of cognitive behavior therapy in which we often go to the person's home and teach them or reteach them how to make these kinds of critical decisions. And what we're finding is that when we challenge them that way, that people are better able to manage the clutter, even if it's not a cure.
Hmm. So you're actually going into the home and doing, that's not done very often these days in the world of mental health treatment.
That's right, but what we're finding more and more is that showing up in a therapist's office and talking about clutter for 45 minutes doesn't really seem to do much.
Right, and the other thing is kind of getting acknowledged is if clutter represents attachment to things, these are often people I would imagine who are lonely, who need attachment, and the idea of a real-life human going into their home can only be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Often we'll encourage them to do more of that, not just with a professional, but once you start to clear out a little bit of space, what we try to teach people is that this is a much better way of getting that feeling of attachment by inviting people to your home or doing things with people, not from hanging on to these things.
Helping to get them what they really need. Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's really been an enlightening show.
That's a pleasure.
My guests have been Marty Franklin and Dr. David Tolan. Franklin's an associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, specializing in anxiety disorder. Dr. David Tolan is co-author of Buried in Treasures, a self-help guide for compulsive hoarding, saving, and collecting. He's also the founder and director of the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Institute of Living in Connecticut. Early on, we heard from Rachel Teacher, who specializes in organizing adults with ADD here in Philadelphia. Tune in tonight to Channel 12 at 9 o'clock for the premiere of my TV special, Learning from the Heart, Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. And join me at noon on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, at the Free Library of Philadelphia when I talk about my new book by that same title. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, email us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped in today's production. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is courageously produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.